Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
This show is a proud member of the Anazal Podcast Network.
We're live. Smile. It's why we have teeth. Welcome, ecologists, to Systematic Ecology, to a drive-in episode, a summer drive-in episode. I'm Andy Walsh. I am here with Liz, and we are going to be talking about the Hunger Games prequel, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. This is part of one of our several annual drive-in series where we take a look at seasonally appropriate films. This one's getting us into the summer kind of blockbuster chill sort of movie. And for this series, we are looking at prequels as part of our Faces Behind Us series. You can find a playlist of all of the movies and podcasts in this series. If you check out the show notes, the link there, we'll send you to the playlist. You can hear all the other summer drive-in prequel discussions. I know there's a Rise of the Planet of the Apes in there somewhere. There's almost certainly some kind of Star Wars prequel. Check out, see what all the different movies are going on there. We'll just kind of jump right in here. We've just gotten out of the film. What were your kind of first reactions to seeing this particular Hunger Games installment?
Yeah, I remember we very rarely will like go to the movies to see something, but with this you just had to go, right? And I didn't want any spoilers, so I went and saw it as soon as it first came out. And usually I don't like prequels. Once I know what has happened, I don't care what happened beforehand, right? But with the way the Hunger Games was written, it's just such a hot mess, this society. We have to know what happened before to create this hot mess, right? And even then, it didn't even answer all of my questions, but it was such a good movie. It makes me like just want to watch it even more, or like know more storyline about the Hunger Games.
All right. For me, I watched it just a few weeks ago in preparation for this episode. I had seen the previous Hunger Games films more or less as they came out, whenever that was, a number of years ago. My wife had read the books, and so she was interested in them. But I had not checked out this prequel until now. And yeah, I thought it was fine. And I thought, mostly what kind of stood out to me was the very elaborate series of Chekhov's snakes and different things that were set up. There were whole lots of foreshadowing or a whole lot of plot mechanics that were kind of put in place as the movie went along that all sort of clicked in at the end. Some maybe a little bit more successfully than others. But
wait, so you just saw this for the first time 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, 2 or 3 weeks ago, something like that. Yeah.
That's crazy. Well, thanks for letting me choose the one prequel I enjoy.
Well, what kind of monster would it be if I said, no, we have to watch a prequel that you hate?
You made me watch The Hobbit or something. I did watch it. I just did not enjoy it.
Yeah.
Don't hate me. Yeah. I like Lord of the Rings, guys. Don't hate me.
Yeah. I think there is room in the geek world for people who enjoyed the Lord of the Rings films and were less keen on the Hobbit films. I don't think that's a particularly outrageous take. I also
just didn't want to get canceled.
I hear you. I would also say that even though they came out afterwards, they're not really prequels in the sense that, the Hobbit was written for, like, the story was written in a more chronological fashion. It's just that they made the movies in a different fashion. But
I didn't know that.
At least I'm pretty sure.
Was this
maybe I'm gonna get canceled?
Maybe. Sorry if all those Tolkien fans out there. Since your wife read the books, was this book written after the first three Hunger Games?
This is a Hunger Games, true Hunger Games prequel in the sense that the book came out and after the first few Hunger Games movies.
I chose a true prequel. I didn't even realize. Look at me go.
Yeah, good job.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there might have been some amount of, those movies made a lot of money. Any chance you could write another book for us so we could make it into another movie? I'm not sure, but it kind of had that vibe of.
Well, and it felt, I think because she just did such a great job building this world that it feels very Purge-esque, you know what I mean? Like this could never happen, but also we're not too far from a reality where maybe. You know?
Yeah.
Like we can envision it happening. So not to the extent of the Purgs, but I mean, we have the Olympics with other countries where we compete and try and see who's the best and all that kind of whatnot. So just like the competition and I mean, the social, I'm trying to think of the socialism in there and just how the different classes, like it just covers a lot of topics that are relevant in today's society.
Sure. So maybe I'll summarize for folks a little bit of the plot and then we can unpack those themes a little bit more. So the Hungarian films were about a fictional dystopian society called Panem, where there's a capital region and then 12 districts of very sort of working class to middle class job. You know, they all kind of have one job. It's kind of a little bit of Star Wars, like you know, each planet has one thing. Each district is sort of one thing and all in the service of the wealthy people in the capital. And there had been in the past, there had been some kind of revolution and the districts lost and the capital won. And to remind them of that every year, two people from every district are sent to participate in the Hunger Games where they all just kind of fight it out to the death till there's one person left standing. So the original books were, you know, like the 74th Hunger Games or something like that. And then the 75th Hunger Games, I think something in that range. So here now we're going back to not the very first Hunger Games, but the fifth or the 10th or something like that in this film. And they're much more, not exactly analog, but lo-fi, right? The first films, the Hunger Games had like digital holograms and all kinds and robots and all kinds of fancy things. It was sort of like, a death match in the holodeck, but this is much more just here's an arena, here's some sticks with pointy edges, go forth and battle it out, and we'll watch on our very 1950s-esque looking televisions. And so we get the story of Cornelius Snow, who's the president in the later films, sort of his origin of how he went from a young student in the capital to being perhaps sympathetic to the cause of the districts, or maybe just doing it for opportunistic reasons, and then eventually becoming the terrible person that we see in the later films, played by Donald Sutherland. So yeah, you know, in a nutshell, I guess that's there's a love story there. You know, whether he really loves the young woman or not, or again, it's just kind of an opportunistic thing. She's in the Hunger Games. He's supposed to help her. So he invents a bunch of the things that we came to see later in the Hunger Games. The idea of a person sort of sponsoring one of the tributes in the Hunger Games. The idea of sending gifts to the people in the arena as they're competing. The idea of sort of showing them off beforehand so that people would develop sympathy for them. He kind of takes the Hunger Games from being this like purely gladiatorial thing to a bit more of the spectacle that it was in the Jennifer Lawrence films. Is that fair? Yeah,
and I would say it's fair. And what makes me enjoy this prequel, I've said it before, but usually I hate when you humanize villains. I just want to hate someone and be, you know, not every villain needs a backstory. But they didn't really try and humanize President. They didn't try to like redeem President Snow really in the prequel. They just kind of showed his story and like how he became who he was. But they didn't like really make excuses for it, which I kind of appreciated. But it is just crazy to think of someone so evil. He's just a part of the system. Like he wasn't like no one's. This could be like really philosophical. Like I don't believe no one's is born good or evil. You know what I mean? It's like a progression of growth, and it's what society makes them. So just kind of seeing in his adolescence in this prequel how society shaped him, because he actually grew up really, really poor and like hungry, and he had to like pretend to be something he wasn't his whole life. And so this was his chance for like the taste of fame, or like the taste of like kind of like the high society, because yes, he was in a district that was, you know, prevalent in more of the other districts, like because different districts had its rankings with social class, but he was the bottom of the top, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really know what that would feel like, but you can kind of just imagine how much of an outsider he felt, and then falling in love and getting betrayed. And yeah, it's just, I still can't wrap my head around the whole movie. We should have had your wife on here, man.
I'm sorry.
You could have educated us so much.
It's okay. I'd go get her, but she's in another state right now, so that's not going to work.
Oh, yeah, no. Sad day. It's okay.
Yeah, I think you're right that there's a clear sense along the way that he is responding to various incentives in front of him. Whether reluctantly, he's doing so with gusto, I think there's some room for interpretation, right? How human of a person did he start out as, and did the system kind of warp him by presenting him with these twisted incentives? Was he always a little bit warped, and or was he maybe not always, but was he already warped by the time he becomes the main character of the story? And that's why he responded to the incentives in that way. But there's definitely, it's not just this man always, you know, tries to find the most evil thing that he can do at any given moment. No, he's responding to a system that is already somewhat in place, and just trying to navigate what's the most advantageous for him in any given moment.
It makes me think of I watched some kind of politician show not too long ago, and like someone, you go in bright eyed, bushy tailed, wanting to make a difference, but in order to make a difference, you have to, so you're not eaten alive and, you know, spit out, you have to kind of play the system to get into the system. But then a lot of the times, like with politicians, I mean, we see it with doctors, lawyers, any of these high profile occupations, they end up becoming a part of the problem and not fixing it, because the problem is so big. One person cannot fix healthcare. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they want to be a good doctor, but then the hospital and the CEO wants them to overbill and run up their charts so they can make a profit. And so like, what can you do? It's kind of like a similar situation with, so that's why I think I like these movies so much, because you can just relate them in today. Like, I feel like, obviously, we won't be, hopefully, killing each other. But if they created some kind of like hierarchy system game or whatnot, I feel like society would just go completely for it, and it would get out of control like it did in the Hunger Games.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something to be said for allegorizing or adding a layer of metaphor to current issues so that it makes it easier for people to engage with them. Right? So you're not... You can put aside a little bit of the, oh wait, they're picking on me, and engage at a level of ideas and abstractions rather than, oh, it's me and my group that are being criticized or targeted and so forth. But yeah, it is interesting to see, you know, how much does he want to reform the system from the beginning, or is that just a convenient stance to take as a young person among his peers? There seems to be some enthusiasm for that, so is he adopting that stance because that's what's politically favorable in the beginning? I don't know, but yeah, you do kind of get the feeling of that, of exactly that arc you described, of he might have some ambition of creating a better system for Pan Am when he starts out, but by the end of the film he's very much committed to the status quo and whatever power it can provide for him.
Did you have a favorite scene or anything? I wouldn't call this my favorite scene, but when you were talking about how the first like Hunger Games movies we saw, it was super futuristic, and they were almost like death celebrities, if you will. Mm-hmm. Like people, that's just how much they got glorified down the road. But with this one, as you said, it was more archaic. And I just thought it was very symbolizing. They would put their tributes in this one and like the early Hunger Games in a cage. And so like they took away the humanity with these tributes in a way to make it feel like animals.
Yeah. I mean, they're literally in a zoo, or at least a zoo, an enclosure that reads like a zoo. Mm-hmm. at the start. And that's one of Snow's innovations. It says, hey, maybe if we humanize these people a bit more for the audience of the Hunger Games, people will engage more. Because the problem he's trying to solve is we're 5 or 10 years into this experiment, and already people are the ratings are dropping. People aren't interested anymore. They've lost their bloodlust a little bit, or whatever it was that was getting them to tune in for the first few years. So how do we get people back in? And he approached that by building sympathy for the individual tributes.
Mm-hmm. And then he discovered that Lucy could sing, and so then that almost made it all also more showy instead of just gory. So I mean, really, he transformed the whole games. And this one is the Songbirds. Remind me, is this before the other book? Like, there's another book my roommate tried to get me to read it. The one with Hamish story. Is this before Hamish story or after Hamish story? That movie's coming out.
Yeah, my understanding is that this is before, because that Hamish's story is about the concept of the quarter quell that they come up with, which in the first books and movies is very obviously, well, we did the Hunger Games, but you can only ever be a tribute once. So how do we have the climax of the second story also be a Hunger Games? And, mm-hmm. and so, you bring back past tributes to participate, to compete in an okay. all-star tournament. So, yeah. So I believe the that book and the film that is coming out, later this year or next year, I think it's next
November
year,
20th.
Later this year. Is that first sort of all-star Hunger Games.
I guess that makes sense, because if I kind of think about how old Hamish is and how old Snow is, there's no way it was before.
Right.
So this movie is so far the earliest you can see of
correct
the society.
Correct.
Okay.
So you asked about a favorite scene. I mean, that zoo-like sequence where he discovers that she can sing is a very good one. I think really my favorite thing about the movie, maybe less the scene and more just Jason Schwartzman's, he's playing Lucky Flickerman, the TV host, the TV presenter of the broadcast of the Hunger Games, in a precursor to Elizabeth Banks' character. And I forget, they have somewhat fanciful names that I'm not remembering at the moment, but her sort of TV presenter character, is a much more, again, refined, advanced version of his, very like 1950s pitch man, reading ads, now, a word from our sponsor kind of stuff from 1950s television. But yeah, he's clearly just having, Jason Schwartzman's clearly just having a grand old time, hamming it up. And I was enjoying that along with me. And, even though he is also part of this, very flawed and evil system, he's perhaps the most entertaining character. He's not actively murdering people or conspiring to murder people, and so he's just a little bit easier to hate less. And I guess that's part of his role in the story as well, right? Is to provide a sheen of entertainment and respectability to this murder show.
I wonder how we would be as a society. Because, I mean, if you think about it, people love the MMA fight scenes. Mm-hmm. And MMA is real, right? Boxing is, no, wrestling is fake, but MMA is real, right?
Well, I mean, there are forms of wrestling that are real, like in the Olympics and whatnot. But professional wrestling, WWE and so forth, yes, that is scripted entertainment.
So why do people watch it?
Why do people watch any kind of scripted entertainment? Right. They are a very good job. They do a very good job of creating an entertaining product and creating characters that you want to root for and characters that you love to hate and all that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just, instead of it being, a drama, a straight drama where the plot takes place in a school or a workplace or what have you.
The
drama takes place in a ring, and yeah, and they pretend to punch each other.
All right, fun stuff. But just kind of thinking back of like, how would we be as a society? I think of the gladiator, the games, and I think of people loving the MMA fighters and stuff. It's kind of scary how close we could change.
Yeah, or, you know, I mean, again, maybe I'll get canceled for this because I'm sure these shows have their fans, yeah. But like the Mr. Beast game show, the Squid Game, not the scripted Squid Game show, but Squid Netflix created some kind of, I forget exactly what it was called, but it was like, you know, the real Squid Game sort of thing. And, mm-hmm. you know, they're not intentionally setting out to kill people. And as far as I know, they, you know, no one has actually been that seriously harmed by any of these things. But, you know, even Survivor to a certain extent has it. I'm like, part of what makes it compelling, whether it's real or not, and it's probably more like, you know, professional wrestling than like MMA fighting, if we're honest about the level of peril on some of these things. Nevertheless, what they're selling it on is that, you know, you could watch somebody come to serious harm. You could watch, you know, somebody have some of the worst moments of their life on this desert island or in this, you know, maze pit, whatever. I haven't watched any of the Mr. Beast show other than the advertisements that come up on the, my Fire Stick when I log in. But, you know, I there was clearly a lot of criticism for that about the lack of, concern that it had for its and contestants, that, you know, the outrageous nature of the games that they're coming up with. So it's not hard to imagine that, you know, even without creating an entire dystopia, you know, that we could keep pushing this kind of that kind of entertainment to the point where, oh, actually now something has gone tragically wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think about all the views, because I've seen a few of them, like whenever, like with YouTube or TikTok, was like, don't watch, this is graphic, but mm-hmm. it still has like 1 billion views, and it's like murder and all that. People love the true crime documentaries. It's just,
yeah,
which is not wrong. Like, you know, I love watching Law and Order, but I know it's fake at the end of the day.
Right.
Well, it's not fake. It's based on true events, but it's crazy to think about how this came from someone's mind. And it was a really good prequel with, like, it didn't feel like fabricated to fit the other three movies. It felt like it just flowed really well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think it is integrated well. There's maybe a little bit much of the, and here's the origin for this, and here's the origin. I think where it lost me was the origin of Katniss Everdeen's name, the Jennifer Lawrence character. Her name, like, mm-hmm. they call this plant swamp potatoes or whatever, but I like to call it Katniss. Like, oh, okay. We don't have to have the origin story for every last element of.
Yeah, they did that with a lot of the musical tones too.
Right. The music and the Jabberjays, like everything that, you know, was distinctive about those first films, you know, has some origin here. But, you know, thinking of origins and Face of Mine, I want to wrap up soon here, but I wanted to think a little bit more about, you know, the influences on Snow's character, right? So we have Viola Davis's character, who is sort of the current political leader. We've got Peter Dinklage's character. He's sort of the guy who's behind the Hunger Games or engineering the Hunger Games. And then we have Snow's absent father, who's passed away. All kind of loom large in its influences in his life. Did you have any kind of thoughts about who was most significant or whether those influences were beneficial or not?
I mean, I feel like none of the influences on Snow's life has been influential. Maybe his little sister kind of like motivated him to work harder, but because of that, at the beginning of the movie, he's pretty much giving her his food and he's going hungry. So it shows that he's kind, and it also just influences, like, once he gets all this power to take care of his family, he doesn't want to lose it. And then, the three you named, I can't think of any, like, cause it's been a while since I watched the movies. Because when I tried to find it, I couldn't find it for free to watch. It was very sad. It's fine. If you want to share pirating sites, I do not condone pirating, but you can tell me where to watch it, guys, in the comments. But I just feel like the society as a whole, like, just influenced him. I remember whenever he's like talking to his friends, keeping up with the Joneses, like it's no one thing that created his personality or one person.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that that kindness that you mentioned maybe comes from his grandmother, who seems to be the one that's raising him and his sister. But you know, I think it's interesting because there's sort of a negative space element to it, right? There's clearly the, you know, Viola Davis, you know, is mentoring him in a certain fashion. I think Peter Dinklage is sort of trying to mentor him, but kind of in a negative way, like pushing him away from certain things rather than steering him towards something. And maybe that's why he ultimately fails, because he doesn't have a good alternative to offer. He's just sort of saying, no, don't do that. But I think there's also a real negative space in terms of he maybe needed more of his father's influence in his life. But his father mm-hmm. isn't there. All right. Well, we just want, you know, we like to release drive-in episodes to be kind of quick hits, quick dives into these stories. So I think unless you have any final parting words on Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, maybe we can wrap it up there.
No, I think we're good. I mean, I'm ready to rate and review it.
All right. Well, yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10, what kind of rating would you give this?
Because I always do it based on my desire to watch it again, because I can watch a good movie, but if I only watch it once, you can't be that high, right? Sure. So I'm going to do like a 9 because I really want to watch it. And I did watch the first 3 Hunger Games not too long ago in preparation for this episode, but then I couldn't find this one for free. I was very sad. I should just rent it. It's not that much money.
Fair enough. I'd probably be more in the like 7 range, I think. You know, it was fairly well done. The snake biology maybe got a little bit goofy for me, but that's a topic for another time. But yeah, so, well, you know, that's our rating for the movie. You can also rate and review our podcast wherever you are downloading this, and we always appreciate that. And if the folks want to have a cool, refreshing beverage as they're watching their summer drive-in movie, do you have a flavored tea or lemonade that you would recommend?
Well, yes, I can't remember if this one's shown on YouTube or not, but if you guys have been watching, I've been downing a Sprite Zero. That is my beverage of choice at the moment. So not tea or lemonade, but Sprite Zero.
You know, it's kind of a lemonade.
Yeah, it has lemon lime.
Yeah.
Artificial flavor.
Exactly. Well, you know, as a husband to a native daughter of Latrobe, Pennsylvania, I would be remiss if I didn't recommend an Oliver Palmer, which is a 50-50 blend of iced tea and lemonade. So that would be my suggestion.
Your wife would be proud.
I'd like to think so. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, again, thanks for listening. Check out the other episodes in our summer drive-in series for more prequel fun. And remember that if you're going to geek, do it systematically.
Hey guys, I really hate to interrupt, but my name's TJ, and I'm here to tell you about our new merch. We have incredible new stuff with Fourth Wall. We have just partnered with them as a new store. They have a lot more to offer, which means we have a lot more to offer. We can now offer you beautiful Comfort Colors t-shirts. They're so comfy. I wear mine all the time, and we've got it all now. Cups, hats, backpacks, pajamas. If you want your systematic geekology pajamas, you know where to go. My personal favorite is actually our Throne of Geeks shirt. It is Comfort Colors, you know, blue, black, green, red, orange. And the shirts are just so nice. And the shirt itself, we've got the Throne of Iron geeked out, because, you know, that's our brand. We've got Mjolnir on there, the Buster Sword, Trident. Basically, just the coolest weapons from our favorite properties are on the shirt, instead of a bunch of normal boring swords from the boring series Game of Thrones. So check that out. And thank you.
Hey everybody, this is Alex Matthews, and I'm just here to share with you guys about the Anasal Network. Hope you guys could check out Page and Pixel, which is a podcast about books and video games. Another podcast we would love for you to check out is Your Matter Matters. It's a podcast that puts the and in faith and science. We got Let Nothing Move You with Christian Ashley going through the whole Bible one chapter at a time. And last but not least, another one called Some Joyful Muses, a music podcast with no rhyme, rhythm, or reason. This show has no set schedule or host, but periodically has some members from the NSL Network posting discussions about various musical topics, everything from Taylor Swift to the music of Adventure Time and more. So I hope you guys will give those a listen, because I definitely will. As a matter of fact, I'm about to hit that subscribe button right now, and you should too.